Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Slasher Crasher, the debut horror comedy novel of David Nora. It was the night he tried to get home but got caught in their drama. It's Halloween, and Nick Roche is a towering figure of evil and stupidity. He's escaped from an upstate New York mental hospital he's been committed in for 5 years. Planning to return to his childhood home where he brutally murdered his babysitter's boyfriend, his plans are halted when he crosses paths with even more terrifying beasts. Two high school friends with some serious beef. Caught in a battle of loyalty that has been brewing for 10 years of their friendship, the two girls, Kathleen and Betsy, force the feud into a savage showdown, pitting the escaped monster against each other. Who will survive this epic deathmatch, and is it totally wrong to fall in love with the murderous lunatic who just tried to kill your best friend with a machete? It's available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and at BlackRoseWriting.com. For more info, you can find David Nora on Twitter and Instagram at David Nora Jr. Again, the novel is called Slasher Crasher.
All right, and welcome to episode 162 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob Galuzzo. I'm here with Elra Kane. What's up?
Man, it's October, finally.
It's October,
and
officially.
Yet this is the only time we'll be all together for a little while, so it's
a little bit.
1 week. Well, and then I see you guys again in Knoxville.
Rebecca McKenzie's
here. Hey, I'm
here
too, guys.
That's right. Ryan's still on set. He's not calling in today.
Oh, he's not? You tried? I didn't try.
I did try.
Happy birthday to Ryan.
Yeah, well, yeah, so it was his birthday. Yesterday. His birthday this week, so happy birthday to him.
Which makes him the ultimate Halloween kid. I know Becca also has a birthday.
Yeah, my birthday's next week.
Oh, my God.
But well, I mean, being
October.
The first,
yeah. You know. October 1st seems like ideal for Ryan.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. I wish I was an October kid, but whatever. Born in the summer.
What star sign are you, Rob?
What sign?
What star sign are you?
I'm a Leo.
I could tell you're a Leo.
Really? Yeah. How? By the tone of my voice?
Yeah. This is a different podcast, guys.
You have the strength of a lion.
Oh, sure. Yeah, whatever. Man, a lot of stuff to talk about, a lot of stuff we've seen. Really cool guest coming up. It's been an emotional week. I'm just going to say it out front and out loud. To people listening, to a lot of our friends, to Ryan Rawlings, to Daniel Harrington, who has the Shockwaves tattoo.
I wrote that down too. Look at the bottom, Daniel Harrington. I was going to give a shout out as well.
Yeah, Ryan Larson. A lot of people, you know, what I love about the group is kind of the community effort and the fact that people have each other to talk to.
Yeah.
Trust me, for all of us in this room, life isn't easy every week either. And so, thank you for sticking with us. We'll stick with you too, and this
and
is why we
reach
do.
Out. Always reach out
always
to
reach
someone.
Out.
You're never fully alone, even if you're physically alone. There are people who have your back. Other people who might not even know you that well, who still want to make a difference if they can.
So yeah, so there you have it. Yeah. This show's for you.
Yeah,
literally,
totally for them.
Love
so,
you guys.
Yeah. All right, and all the other stuff I don't want to get into on air. So, let's talk. Fucking movies.
Well, Halloween season, guys. Did you guys do anything Halloween yet? I mean, I've purchased every pumpkin product that Trader Joe's has.
Yeah, I've upped my pumpkin cereal. Well, because normally you go for the monster cereals, and this is the first year I was like, I can't. They're not
You're
good.
You're an adult. No, they're not. I tried
Wow,
cranking.
You grew up this year.
They're not. Yeah. But you know what I do like is I like pumpkin spice Cheerios.
Oh, yeah.
And the pumpkin mini wheats.
Ooh.
Those are the two. They're at Target. They're delicious, and they're slightly more healthy than those damn monster cereals, which are just pure sugar.
Well, pumpkin JoJo's are always my jam. Trader Joe's has them once a year. Why they don't have them year-round is beyond me. It's literally like two ginger snaps with a bunch of pumpkin frosting shoved in the middle. It's just amazing. And then I did pear apple cider from Trader Joe's. And then I went to Disneyland's doing their whole Halloween celebration. So I went to that this weekend and had pumpkin fudge, which was, again, like pumpkin cream cheese frosting, but solidified into a tasty square. It was amazing.
Mm, nice. All I had is a pumpkin spice latte, which I wait till October 1st to have. I'm not one of these freaks who drink them year round, thinking that that is acceptable behavior.
How do you get them all year round?
No, you can, because a lot of places will just carry pumpkin spice all year round.
Like I'm unaware.
I remember John used to try this at Jump Cut, and I never approved. But for me,
he would make pumpkin spice latte.
We only sell that. For me, it's psychological. So October 1st, I had one. It felt great, and what I loved about this year is October 1st was actually the first cold day we had had in forever, and I could actually feel the difference on the day, and I love that.
Yeah. So that's what I was talking about last night. I was telling them about how I was standing in line at the drugstore buying candy corn, but what I ended up also getting was an apple cinnamon scented candle, and came home and opened the windows and lit it just so I could feel the cold air and smell the apple cinnamon, and it was wonderful. And then watched horror. So. But Beyond Fest, I know Auric's been a couple times because we've been
And that does also feel like the season. If you live in LA, those two things go together. Yeah, we're there opening night last week.
For
last
Colorado Space.
Oh. Yeah, Richard Stanley's much awaited follow-up, 25 years since he's directed a film. This is also being heralded as a major H.P. Lovecraft adaptation.
And that it is. It is quite possibly one of the most kind of true to text H.P. Lovecraft adaptations I've seen in a long time, which is weird because he also updates it heavily.
Yeah. So, well, what I say about this film, I had a really good time. This was a blast. The good news for people worrying, because I worried going into it, I was just like, as Richard Stanley, you know, 25 years is a long time. I thought he might have lost a step where it might have just been a clunky movie. But the great thing about this film, it's really well made. Mm. Not one point did I go, it's the making of this a problem. The only issue I have with it being a great Lovecraft adaptation, or at least it's being touted as this is the most faithful, is like there's a couple scenes in it that are like really as close as I could imagine. Like remind me of Stuart Gordon type effects. There's a sequence that takes place in an attic, and you see stuff that to me is like, that's Lovecraft. All the things I like about movie Lovecraft, not necessarily written Lovecraft. But this also stars Nicolas Cage, and he's really fun in it. And at times he's really, really good in it.
He's very cagey-ish.
But there's some parts, and it's cagey for a reason. Like his character is undergoing change, so he's allowed to go a little crazy. But there are parts that are like so funny, which is good. It's an entertaining movie. There's a lot of humor to it. But that's where I go, well, that's where Lovecraft and him part ways.
Yeah.
Because Lovecraft isn't exactly known. I mean, obviously, Stuart Gordon did the same thing with Reanimator.
Because we just, Elric and I just watched Reanimator yesterday because I showed it in my horror class at Studio School and you came and sat in. So we had just watched Reanimator as well. And Reanimator starts as a horror comedy, and plus Reanimator strays really heavily from the source material. Like it feels vaguely familiar in that it's kind of a Frankenstein mythos, but not much past that.
And there's another story that gets pulled into Reanimator. I always forget about it.
Charles Dexter Ward.
I think. Something like that,
But yeah, Reanimator, it definitely pushes pretty far away from the subject matter, at least to the best of my knowledge. Whereas Color Out of Space, he was true to form in that it was this isolated rural family and there's something in the well and it's slowly inhabiting them. But Lovecraft is very kind of self-contained in that story. It literally stays close to the family. This, for some reason, kind of blew up in the surrounding town. And honestly, that was my only gripe, is because it did blow up and have a lot of stuff in the town. To me, it felt like Jaws, but with a disease in a well, where like they discover that there's something wrong with the water. And then this scientist shows up and is like, there's something wrong with your water. But then the mayor shows up and says, no, there's not, young scientist. Everybody keep drinking the water and nobody say anything else about the water. And then everybody goes nuts. But it was this kind of like weird Jaws set up.
Yeah, I could imagine editing only 10 minutes, just a few minutes out, but to take out some extraneous characters.
Yeah.
And just limit it to the family. And it's a tight movie. Like, the family stuff's great. Cage is great. There's so many Chongs in it from Cheech and Chong. Oh, wow. He's like living on the property.
Is it long? How long is it?
It's not long.
It's not really about the length. It's like when we're with the family, it's all working. As soon as I get some extraneous character pops in for a few scenes.
And even Cheech Chong is still
kind of like more
he's,
like on the family.
He's probably a drifter who lives on the property. Yeah. So he's connected to the family.
Mm-hmm. But the good news is, look, it's really fun. These are quibbles about it that are stopping it from being like the greatest.
The perfect movie.
Lovecrafted in terms of being a really fun movie, it's actually really entertaining. That, yeah. And that surprised me because I don't really think of entertainment value when I think of Richard Stanley, like with his two South African. They're really interesting movies, but like I don't go for like, that's a good time. Mm. This is actually a really good time. Cage mm-hmm. will make you, you know, it's he's pretty damn funny and fun to watch. It's not quite Mandy level, but he's doing some
oh,
stuff.
I don't
that's
know.
In that
I saw it. It was definitely like Mandy level style outbreaks, but also yeah. he now has like a knife and is really bloody and is prone yeah. to kill people. And yeah.
And the alpaca stuff is fucking
yeah. The family like, raises alpacas really in it.
Well,
and
Nick
it
Cage
just,
does.
Yeah.
And then his family don't understand why he has alpacas. And they keep asking him, like, it's the meat of the future.
Yeah. He sees it as this investment and it literally becomes the punchline throughout the entire movie, but it never gets old.
But I was really torn because that night I went home and yeah, I don't know if you guys ever have this where you compose a tweet that you're like, this is the best tweet I've ever composed. And then you go to send it and then you have some sort of remorse and
I was
delete
wondering
it.
Why you didn't send that.
So yes, I found an alpaca in space. Everything's purple behind it, which is just like the movie. And I think I was going to do one of those one perfect shots, you know, where it's just oh, one yeah. perfect shot. And I even designed it all and I was about to send it. And then I could hear in my head the guys from Spectrevision just going, why couldn't you have taken this film more seriously? Yeah. Like, and I just,
that's
and
not
I
the
stopped.
One I thought you were going to send. I was waiting because you, as soon as Elric and I got out of the movie, he looked at me and he was oh, no, wait. That was a different one. Never mind.
Okay. Yeah.
Never mind.
The,
I'll hold that
the alpaca
for a different
in space cannot
the
be
alpaca
the top.
In space.
It was pretty damn pretty
that
proud
is
of
a pretty
that.
Good
anyway,
one.
Oh, the tweets we didn't send podcast. Wow. That could be its own show. A lot of remorse in that show. But it's really good. I think people are going to enjoy it. So it's a fun movie.
Excellent. Okay. So in addition to seeing that at Beyond Fest, I also watched Belzebuff. On Shudder. Oh,
yeah. You yeah. missed Ryan raving about it last week.
So I really had fun with this movie. I liked this a lot. It's small. I can't
fun.
Call it. It's not. Okay.
I
fun.
Watched the first scene.
Yeah. I told you the opening scene is
I
not
didn't
fun.
Jump into
it's
it.
Intense.
I saw it before Ryan reported, actually, a couple weeks ago. And I just watched the opening. I was like, it was good, but I was like, okay. And
no,
I was just like
and there's,
tired and
there's
sad.
Several more scenes like that. Okay. I won't say the movie's not fun. I will say I was entertained mm-hmm. the entire way. How about that? That's okay. a better descriptor. So literally it is this kind of demonic thing about mass shootings. Hmm. Like it somehow it resonates in contemporary environment. It is about this mass wave that starts in Mexico where all of these people start kind of committing these mass atrocities. And they seem to be targeted at children, but not always. They're just these kind of mass atrocities.
Babies have
and,
coming.
And this one guy who is kind of investigating them, this priest, ends up connected and finding out that there is this other group that believes that it is the second coming of the devil. Like the devil is that Jesus has been reborn as this kid and the devil is trying to find him. And as part of this, or a demon is trying to find him. And that as part of this, that is what is causing all of these horrible things to happen is this demon is getting close to Earth. And that's why all these horrible things are happening. Tobin Bell is in it playing a priest as well with a lot of really bitchin' face tattoos. And the whole thing, it's really well done. And it felt like it was done on a shoestring budget. But at the same time, there were these elaborate set pieces. Like there's one point where they decide that they want to cross into America. And there's this whole set piece in these underground tunnel systems. That was just shocking and claustrophobic and frightening all at the same time. But I really enjoyed this. I was captivated by this movie while I was watching it.
Would have kept watching. It wasn't that the first scene wasn't good. It was that I was very tired after a long day. And when I saw how bleak it was, I was like, I don't think I can do that tonight.
And it keeps going, but there's definitely something with it. I mean, like it's the bleakness that you realize that these horrible atrocities are being done against school children, but that there's a lot of social messaging behind it as well. And because it's set on a Mexican border town, it seems to have a lot of politics of kind of gang violence and drugs and things like that going along with it. It definitely had some charge behind it. There was a lot of messaging behind, not just violence. Like there was definitely some messaging behind it. And the one of the other stars who plays one of the, I believe he was a priest in it, he may have also been a detective, is Tate Ellington, who was the lead in The Endless.
Oh, right.
And he was really good in it as well.
Speaking of gang violence and drugs, tell me what Fulci movie did you watch?
gang violence and drugs. They're not. That's not in the one I watch. No, but okay.
You go with what you got.
You're talking about Wax Mask, which is now available through Severn Films.
I definitely saw it when I was young and remember nothing about it. I remember it wasn't good at the time, but that doesn't mean it's not good.
It's all right. So here's the deal. It's an okay movie. It's presented by Dario Argento. It was intended to be a Lucio Fulci movie. Instead, Lucio died, and it was directed by Sergio Stivaletti, who is their longtime effects artist.
Yeah.
And so watching it now, it's 1997. So kind of like that whole Italian era of horror is kind of over,
right, at this point.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a pretty cool movie. The Blu-ray looks fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, technically, it's very loosely based on like Phantom of the Opera and the original Wax Legend. What's funny about it is I definitely noticed a Waxwork influence on it because there's literally – like in the movie Waxworks, which is, in my opinion, flawless and a lot of fun,
there's a
moment in that movie where there's a cop who's like looking at pictures and it's cut to like the way the fan is spinning and he's having flashes of like pieces of the displays and he's seeing the victims in the displays and stuff like that. Hmm. This does the exact same scene, like pretty much. There's somebody that's like investigating it who sees it. But yeah, I mean, it's basically a Phantom of the Opera slash, you know, it's take place in Paris, 1900s.
Wow.
It's this guy. The deaths are spectacular, but basically the phantom or whatever you want to call him, who has a scarred face, also has like a metal claw hand.
And so
when he kills people, it's like he like literally goes through their chest to grab their heart and it comes out the other side of the bed.
Oh, that's fantastically Fulci. I love it.
So basically a little girl sees this in the opening sequence and grows up and then we follow her. Yeah. And kind of – so it's got that kind of phantom quality to it. I mean, it's kind of out of control and there's some really silly things in it. I do like the wax. There's something about like the Italian they're all trying to speak English, but it just feels a little off. I mean, that's kind of the joy of Italian horror movies anyway.
Always.
But yeah, this feels kind of more of that – who's the other one? Michelle Soavi.
I put up from from my first post of the Halloween season, I just put up Devil's Daughter yesterday or The Sect.
The Sect, yeah. So this feels a little bit more in that era, but maybe not as you know, he's got a vision.
Yeah, he's a clear director.
This is
more about when you see the gore, it's like really great because it's an effects artist who directed this movie. So
most of us will settle for that these days.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Gore. It's like it's not a great movie, but it's a really fun watch, and I enjoyed it for that. However, the reason that this Wax Mask disc is absolutely essential. There is tons and tons of featurettes that they put on here, all brand new features where they interview everybody from Sergio Stivaletti to the producers to Dario himself. And they all cover all these different aspects of the production. I've watched a few of them, but the standout, it's about 20, 25 minutes long and it's called Beyond Fulci. I never really knew the story behind Argento and Fulci and what their deal was. Mm-hmm. It's hinted upon in a previous documentary that Severin put out called All the Colors of Giallo, where there's audio snippets of Fulci saying, oh, I just don't think Dario likes me or whatever, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, like it's actually kind of funny because like there was like this quote-unquote rivalry. But watching this, you get the full story from Dario.
Oh, and don't tell me it all yet.
I'm not my God, because you just made it sound like the Real Housewives of Italian horror.
Betty versus
Joan. No, the thing I'll tease, because I thought I actually found myself being extremely moved.
Yeah.
And I did a screen grab that I posted of what I thought was the most moving part about it, which is him just saying, I really loved him. And awesome. I believed it. And it's not just him. It's like Dario is telling the story while other people that were there are telling it as well, how they got together.
Oh,
and
cool.
Basically, all Dario says is there's life there's life before I met Fulci and life after I met Fulci.
Yeah.
And before I met him, it was like, I think people in the press and based on our quotes, like, I think they made it seem like he was like jealous of what I was doing, even though I already had respect for him and this and that. And maybe I was a little arrogant because I heard him saying things about me, etc. But like the second we were in the same room together, it was like, oh, I like this guy. We're okay.
That's cool.
And that's what it, when it became, let's work together. Let's make something. And so
it's funny how they also have nothing in common. Like when I look at their two styles, they couldn't be more different filmmakers. They're like opposite sides, even though they're both Italian. They're just
I mean, again, and I don't want to spoil the whole story. You have to see it for yourself. Yeah. But like the beautiful thing was them really, really trying to make this movie. Like Dario Argento presents a Lucy Fulci movie. Fulci was in poor health. He really didn't get his due while he was alive. Yeah. And like he was in bad shape. Like this is almost like a favor. Like we're going to give you a movie, you know, that's going to be a big release. And he, you know, he was living in a town where nobody really knew him, and he moved back to the city. And Dario is telling the story. He's like, he went to the movies every day. He loved movies so much, and he would go every single day to see whatever was out because he just how passionate he was. Yeah. So it's just this whole thing is worth it for that whole story, including, you know, I only knew the details of his death like very sporadically, but Dario like explains exactly how he died, and it's like actually kind of heartbreaking and sad.
Aww.
And so like this is just great. Like literally Wax Mask the movie is pretty good. This Beyond Fulci featurette is like one of my favorite things that Severin's done in a while.
Awesome.
So that alone is worth this disc.
No, I'm really
and I just handed you a
so
copy
I can
of
watch
it. So Wax Mask, definitely a worthwhile investment as far as I'm concerned.
TV and movies. Creepshow 1 and 2.
Yeah, that's right.
The new Creepshow came out. Perfect to work out to because that's how I watched both of these.
I watched the first episode.
Yes.
There's only one episode. They're every week instead of...
Two segments
per episode.
Did you see both segments?
I only watched the Nicotero one and then I stopped.
I feel... Like where one of the problems I have with this so far is that there's no hint of like the Creepshow like lighting aesthetic, and not that it needs to come into the show, but I was like, oh come on, even a transition. There's things about actually the second one, had it been like 12 minutes, I think would have been really good. It's a little long for what it has, and has no ending.
I really like the second.
But yeah, it's a zombie, a little zombie toy head appears in this dollhouse.
So I should keep going.
Definitely watch it. And let me preface it by saying I don't think either of these fully nail it. I think they're both kind of interesting. They feel a little cheap at times, but I'm hoping, you know, the first one has big stars and the practical monster part's cool, but then it relies on CG. The second one just didn't have an ending. I don't want to run it for people, but I kept going, oh, if this had a big ending, it would be bonkers. But I definitely feel after watching, I'm like, I bet you this is just going to keep, there's going to be some really good ones ahead. There's some really interesting directors in this lineup. But I was a little, had it been called... remember the Tales from Dark Side show?
Yeah.
Yes.
It felt more like that than it felt like Creepshow to me. There wasn't much to make it feel like Creepshow yet. The head of the zombie for sure.
That was a great little segment.
But also the skeleton just, it's hard, man, because the problem is I also watch it right after getting back into Tales from the Crypt.
Oh, man,
And Tales from the Crypt is so organic to those wraparounds where the Crypt Keeper talks, and then this one, they're clearly not wanting it to talk because that would be a ripoff of the Crypt, and instead he's like, what's he doing? He's just kind of walking around. So look, I will save judgment because I liked them. I had fun. But I wasn't like blown away yet, and want to be blown away.
I think for me, I really liked it a lot. I think for me, yes, it the segments are cool. I mean, this is kind of the deal with anthology horror anyway. Mm-hmm. Is like there's things you're gonna like, there's things you're not gonna like. I was pleasantly surprised by kind of the effects and the stuff they did in it. I don't think it feels 100% Creepshow, like you're saying. Like, I don't know if they incorporated the color scheme in comics the way they should have.
Even if it's just a transition, I think roll with it.
But just starting, it's not, it's actually, I think it's really cool. I think, you know, we were hearing slightly mixed reaction out of they did a big premiere here at the Egyptian, and we're hearing slightly mixed reaction out of it. And my feeling, so I had a lower bar, and hence it exceeded it for me because I think if you're seeing it on the big screen, you're expecting the Creepshow movie.
It's a movie.
Seeing these once a week on Shudder is pretty cool.
Yeah.
To me, I was like, oh, no, okay, yeah, this is a Creepshow show.
It's like a workout thing. Like, you watch it, it's like, oh, that was cool.
Yeah.
And plus, like you say with anthology, I'm expecting that some will be really great and some will not be as interesting.
And again, I also like, I'm into the idea of not binging it. Like, I like that every Friday – you know, there's Rob Schraub has an episode this Friday when this airs.
Okay,
it's
I'll
a
watch
werewolf
it.
One.
Okay,
yeah. So
I'm in,
like,
for Schraub.
Yeah, it's like I want to see his werewolf segment for sure.
I loved the TV show. Its name is escaping me right now, about the cops that were investigating the paranormal stuff that last year. That ran for like just a couple episodes, but I loved it. So yeah,
and also David Bruckner has two. I think Roxanne Benjamin has some. There's a bunch of names.
That,
But yeah, no, I'm definitely curious. But it's also sometimes hard with, like, they had a lot of big names in that first one.
Yeah.
And so that's, I watch that from my side and go, there's your money. You know, it's like a lot of that has to get gobbled up with that. But the monster itself, there's a moment where it looked pretty bonkers. What one's, that's Grey Matter, right? Which is a very King one. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was interesting. I'll definitely keep watching. That's for sure.
Excellent. So on anthology shows, I started Two Sentence Horror Stories, which is currently.
Oh, yeah.
So it's on CW. It's also, I don't know if they put it direct there, but it's on Netflix as well. So I've been watching it on Netflix. It just started airing on CW, I think, in August. Mm-hmm. And they've already got like 8 episodes up on Netflix.
They're on 2 seasons on the CW. The first season is available on Netflix now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I watched the first couple episodes of the first season, and I'm loving it, and I'm going to keep going. And you talked about, like, perfect thing to watch at the gym. They're 20 minutes long.
Yeah.
And so it's like exactly like one treadmill use for me. So it was just perfect. Hmm. And I have been absolutely loving these. I think I've done 4 of them. So I'm halfway through.
What is the tone of these? So I've heard of it from someone.
What it is they're taken, it started with a Reddit thread. There was this Reddit thread years ago that I remember seeing when we were still doing Blumhouse.com. And it was write a 2-sentence horror story, right? A horror story in 2 sentences. Right. And so just to give you an example of one of the famous ones, I found a picture on my phone of me sleeping. I live alone. Mm. And so just can you write a horror story in 2 sentences? And so what it is they took this premise and then crafted them out into 20-minute stories. And so you get the little 20-minute story, and then at the end they tell you what the 2 sentences were that inspired the story. Mm. And it was created by a female. A lot of them, and they used a lot of female directors in it as well. And so a lot of them have female protagonists. All of the bulk of the ones that I've watched so far do. But like some, and you'd recognize some of the names, like Ryan Spindel directed one of the episodes. And they're just all really tight, and they function differently. Some of them have been more comedic. They all kind of had that Tales from the Crypt twist to it, like the ironic comeuppance at the end I've discovered so far.
But yeah, but it feels very modern. It was created by Vera Miao.
Mm-hmm.
who came up with Bria Grant. And they both co-directed and co-starred in Best Friends Forever, which is Bria's first movie that she directed. So she's always kind of had – Vera's kind of had her foot in the horror world anyway.
Mm.
And so this feels like a very, very modernized – yeah, I mean, it's kind of cool. I think the 2-sentence story – I think the – I watch a couple of them. I think it starts with sentence one, and then at the end of the episode, the end of the 20 minutes, you get the second
sentence.
So then you see how the whole story came together.
Yeah,
and you're like,
she directed a bunch. It looks like a bunch in the first season and in the second season, actually. So I've been having fun with them. I'm only 4 episodes in, but I'm anxious to get home and watch more just because I've been enjoying them so much. And so that is 2-sentence horror stories currently on Netflix. And I haven't watched it yet, but everybody has been telling me and tweeting at me about a show called Marianne
that is supposed to be
amazing. Like, even Larry Zerner texted me yesterday and was like, have you been watching this yet? So apparently it's great and we all need to go watch Marianne.
French or German film?
French.
I think it's French, because Alyssa was telling me about it. Speaking of Netflix, I was super shocked and pleasantly surprised that they dropped a new movie on last Friday, called In the Shadow of the Moon. And the only reason I knew about this is because it was the day before, and it's Jim Mickle. Who's done Cold as July, Stakeland.
We Are Still Here.
I mean, like,
is
every.
Is he the one who did The Rats, Mulberry Street?
Yes, that was his first movie.
That was his first movie.
So,
and
basically,
I like that one.
Yeah, everything Jim Mickle has done is awesome and really, really great. And so for him to drop a movie on Netflix, which stars Michael C. Hall out of nowhere, and it's kind of a serial killer story. Like, I watched the trailer and the trailer made it seem like it had some First Power vibes to it, which I was all about.
I'm kind of into First Power vibes.
Well, because, you know, the less said, the better. I don't want to spoil anything for you, because basically what's interesting about it is it's a full 2-hour movie, and yet it's broken up kind of into 4 segments. So I can easily have seen it being a show, but at the same time, I kind of liked watching it all in one night. And it's basically you know, Michael C. Hall is a detective, and there is a mysterious girl in a hoodie who has gone around the city and like basically poked people with this device where literally all their insides just start to bleed out. So she simultaneously is killing everybody in town with this strange device, almost like spreading some sort of plague or virus or whatever. And it's really, really fascinating. Like basically Michael C. Hall's brother-in-law, his name is Locke. He's played by Boyd Holbrook. He's the lead guy that's kind of trying to figure everything out, because while the first incident is happening, his wife is at the hospital about to give birth, and it kind of ties into, I mean, as the title says, in the shadow of the moon, kind of ties into the whole lunar cycle, which again could be supernatural, could be sci-fi. The less you know, the better. I was in for the full ride, and
could be the Tooth Fairy.
They did. Yeah. Remember,
he likes the, have you ever seen blood in the black moonlight? It appears quite black.
Yeah. No, it's really cool. It's a crime mystery. It's got a sci-fi element. I think halfway through you'll probably figure it out, but that doesn't make the ride any least interesting. Again, and Jim Mickle's one of those filmmakers that I just – every time he does something –
he was also doing Happen Leonard, the show, for a long time.
That's true. Yeah. So I just love everything. And it's great to see Michael C. Hall again. In the Shadow of the Moon, which is on Netflix right now.
I saw a film called with Dick on the weekend. I think it's a new Scream Factory release of a movie we hadn't seen before, but had seen the cover, Fear No Evil. Look up the cover. It is an absolute blinder of a cover. It's from like 82.
Oh, yeah.
This is from the only other film directed by the Lady in White director.
Yeah.
And Lady in White's a really solid movie. This is a very strange, strange tonal movie. It is basically an Omen ripoff. It's about the reincarnation of Lucifer into the body of a high school boy. Mm-hmm. There's a couple other fallen angels who are in bodies of two different women who are trying to stop him. The opening scene basically feels like a Fulci movie, and it's super exciting, and it's this priest tracking down Lucifer, and it's this really intense showdown. I'm like, oh, what is this movie? And then it goes to high school, and suddenly Ramones are playing every couple seconds. I'm like, how did they afford these, like, the music choices? And they're not even well used. They're just like these incredible music rips. And I'm not sure why on earth they even bothered. And the high school scenes are bonkers, and there's some really weird scenes in here. But then every time it cuts back to like anything to do with the church or like a funeral or a, you know, oh, you've got a power, it is so boring. It is like watching paint literally dry those scenes. And then there will be an utterly bonkers, like total crowd-pleasing moment the next one. So I'm really conflicted with it, because in some ways it's actually a really cool discovery. But these other scenes, just if you edited this thing down, it'd be a much better film. But it's interesting and has a pretty crazy showdown at the end where Lucifer is coming back. The guy who plays the reincarnation of Lucifer is phenomenal. It reminded both of us were commenting as we went, the good scenes reminded us of Martin quite a bit.
Oh,
because
wow.
He's kind of like, you know, he really is the reincarnation, but just the way it's filmed and the way that performance is, it's a really good performance. But it's just a shame when a movie has these other parts, which are probably half the movie, that are just tonally dull and feels like two totally different movies somehow melded together. But for Halloween season, you could do worse than jump in into this one, because it has some really cool stuff in it.
Wow.
Fear No Evil.
Fear No Evil. And I think it's Scream Factory, right, mm-hmm. that did that edition?
I believe so, but it feels like Vinegar Syndrome.
So I watched The Hills Have Eyes 2 from 1984.
Hold on. Dog flashback. All right.
No. I'm getting there.
Arrow.
This is the crazy, psycho, big box set for The Hills Have Eyes 2 from 1984 Arrow put so
even
much
Wes
time.
Craven wouldn't do that.
He didn't
want to make that movie, remember?
I'd like to think this was Ewan Kant, who was on our show from Arrow, and he restored The Prey lovingly. Yeah. So this makes total sense.
This has had so much love put into it. It's like a two-disc. I think it's two-disc. It's a big set. Yeah. It's got a lot on it.
But does the dog do a commentary?
I wish the dog does a commentary. So I had not seen this since I was a kid. And I remembered Rent. I think I may have even seen part two before I saw part one. But I remembered seeing this as a kid. And it is the same characters as the first one. And the setup, it turns into a slasher film, but the setup is that there's a group of motocross, as Brian Fuller posted on my Facebook page, the real criminal here is daylight savings time. So the setup is that a group of motocross racers are driving through the desert to get to a race. And then within the first 5 minutes, they're in the bus, they're joking around. One of them tells the story of these mutant cannibals who used to live around these parts. And then somebody goes, guys, I just realized it's daylight savings time and the race started an hour ago. And so then everybody's like, what the fuck? We're not going to make it in time. We have to take a shortcut through the desert after just telling the story about the crazy mutants. And then coincidentally, they really quickly find out that one of the girls who's with them is actually Ruby from the first movie, but just forgot to tell them that because she thought they would think she's weird. So now group of motocross racers are stranded in the desert because they took the shortcut and then need gas because their gas tank is leaking, double trouble. And so now they're stranded in the desert with Ruby from the original and all these motocross bikes. So then one of the mutants, I think it's Pluto, Michael Berryman, comes up and steals one of the motocross bikes or like fucks with their shit a little bit. And then they're like, we got to get him, guys, motocross style. So then they all hop on their bikes and ride them all around the mountains for the next hour while the mutants gradually pick them off one by one. And that's the whole movie. And the dog has a flashback to the original.
A lot of flashbacks.
Yes.
There's most of the plot from the original comes from the dog's flashbacks.
Your description of this makes it sound like a masterpiece like Breaking Away.
Yeah.
Like this is the motocross Breaking Away in your version.
With mutants.
I'm not
with
sure
mutants.
If you're overselling.
No. There's a lot of motocross action, and I think I'm definitely overselling it. I posted this up rather jokingly about the dog having a flashback and it being like a slasher on motocross bikes.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people were like, man, I just love this movie. And
really?
I get it. Yeah, I get it. Awesome. No, I have ones that I'm like, no. I just love this movie. This does not have that same passion within me. But as we've said before, every movie is someone's favorite. Yep. So to whoever's favorite movie is The Hills Have Eyes from 1984, Arrow has gifted you this absolutely beautiful box set that you need to pick up.
Well, and that's proven by The Prey. Like knowing how much he put into that, it's his favorite movie. I love that the guy whose favorite movie is the guy put it out. I think that's great. That's
no, and what's the dog's name again? I can't remember.
They're Beauty and Beast, and Beauty dies, so they only have Beast left.
Beast, yes, because I remember I used to do on Blumhouse's website, I used to do the hashtag respect, and I wrote a whole respect column to Beast.
Yes.
That's right.
Because he's the dog that saves the day in both movies.
Which is the third coincidence, because now we find out that they happen to be in the same area with the same mutants, and oh yeah, Ruby happens to be on this trip, all grown up. Up now and then, oh yeah, and for some reason they also own Beast, even though it's not those original people, it's new people, but they own Beast.
Wow.
So but
what's the story behind this one? I my memory was that Wes Craven had to do it, was forced to do it for some reason. He did not want to make this movie.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what the exact twist on that was. It was something contractual.
I think it was a contractual thing, but also it was before Nightmare on Elm Street. Basically he was broke. He just needed the money. Yeah. He needed a gig. So that's my understanding is they were going to make it one way or another. And it was like, well, I need to pay rent, so I'm going to do it.
I'm sure it's on the extra features.
Whatever, probably is. Yeah.
I'm sure you can learn all about The Hills Have Eyes 2 on all of the surplus of extra features.
And if you want to keep going, there's a movie from 1995 called Mind Ripper, which was also released as The Hills Have Eyes 3.
Oh.
I think it was Code Red or one of them put it out.
I remember hearing that. I never watched it.
It's pretty wild. Okay. Josh Miller.
Anything to do with the others?
Vaguely.
Okay. Yeah.
there's a desert and...
that's enough.
And yeah.
You've said enough.
A test facility.
Okay.
Actually, I remember it being a lot of fun. I watched it with Steve Scarlatta and Josh Miller. So it should be a best movie he's never made.
Yeah.
Made. That actually did get made.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I meant to that.
Also, I wanted to mention, I have been trying to track down this movie since Udo Kier was on our show last year for my birthday, last August.
Can I intro it by saying one certain line?
Yes.
Is the blood of these horrors killing you?
you're talking about Andy Warhol's Blood for Dracula. Well, technically Paul Morrissey is the writer-director of this. And here's the funny thing. This and Flesh of Frankenstein were put out on Blu-ray, I think by an Australian company, and they were readily available. And it was literally like 2 weeks after Udo was on our show that these things went ridiculously out of print. Hmm. Like so out of print, it was impossible to find it even on foreign sites. And I'm like, why is it impossible to get? And I believe that somebody was trying to get the rights for these. Might have even been severed for a while, but for whatever reason, Paul Morrissey just doesn't want them out there anymore.
He came to my film school when I was in film school, and I spent a whole day with him.
How long ago was this?
Probably 10 years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years. And he, if you watch his movies, they're the most liberal, crazy, sexual, you know, because not just these two, but he also made Heat, Trash, all these just crazy Warhol sex movies and stuff. He is now like one of the most conservative humans, one of the most unpleasant people I've ever met in my life. Just there's something about him that had become so twisted,
Paul Morrissey.
Which is, I think, is fascinating because it does happen. Like there's some people who are so far, like Dennis Hopper, famously, you know, couldn't be more liberal, right? Pot smoker. And then, but by the end of his career, very conservative. And you're just, so it's interesting that, you know, these shifts, but Paul Morrissey, it was like everyone was kind of shocked because of the films versus who he was now, and he hated everything out of his mouth was like hatred towards Warhol. Everything he told he never did anything, he just used me, and the whole thing was just like, oh god, way to buzzkill. Like we just watched his movies and we're excited to talk to him, and then it was like,
well, apparently because of that, you can't really get the movies.
They probably pulled them all. Yeah,
but anyway, long story short, shout out to Aaron Dries, our author and frequent guest and friend, because they are still available in little stores in Australia. And so he bought them for me.
Little
and
Stores?
Them.
Is that actually a brand? Little
no. like I saw them on the Amazon. I literally looked every Amazon in every country to see if I could find this freaking thing. And it came up in Australia, but they wouldn't ship it to the US. Huh. And so I messaged him. I was like, can you buy this from your Amazon? And he's like, you know what? I'm sure I could find it at just a store. Huh. And so he did find them and, to his word, mailed me both movies. But I threw on Blood for Dracula because I've always wanted to see beautiful Udo in his prime as Dracula.
He's great.
I kind of loved it. It's really good.
I like it way more than Flesh for Frankenstein. Like,
see,
I think it's
I'm glad
better.
I didn't watch that one first because I guess
that one's interesting,
heard,
but this one's just way more atmospheric. I think.
Yeah, no, it's
I
atmospheric.
I love this one. Yeah. He's great. I love both of them.
He's beautiful. It's like there's some gnarly, basically like the boy that like cleans up the house is sleeping with every single one of the daughters. And so every time he tries to drink their blood, like he like vomits.
He can only drink virgin blood.
Yes,
so
exactly.
That's why he says the blood of these whores is killing me.
Yes,
one of the great
lines. It's wonderful. And
it's actually got a very Vittorio De Sica, who's like one of the most famous Italian directors of all time, who made Art House, very serious fare in the 60s, is one of the lead actors in it, which is super weird too.
Yeah.
I can't remember. He's Count something, the guy whose house it's at. it's a really, like, he really has got an incredible face. A little bit like young Terrence Stamp,
who also has an amazing
face. Just incredible features. You know?
Yeah, and it was actually pretty darn gory
for what it was. Blood is really bloody.
Yeah.
This one wasn't in 3D. Only Flesh for Frankenstein.
I think only Flesh for Frankenstein, not, and the disc is not in 3D. These are just regular versions. But they are really great, crystal clear high def versions of them. Cool. So this was the great way to see, because, you know, Dracula over the years, of course I always loved Bella, but I've never been a huge Dracula fan. I'm just now in the last year or two getting into the Christopher Lee stuff and checking that out. But like, he's always been one of my least favorite of the Universal Monsters because I didn't fully get, you know, Dracula. So now I'm starting to veer out and watch different interpretations of it.
How are you down with Langella?
I do. I really love the Langella
really
one.
Good.
And it took me years to watch it because I had to wait for that uncolored version.
I haven't rewatched it since I was a kid.
Well, Scream Factory is putting out the Blu-ray and it's going to have both versions of it on. So there's that. It's really, really good. And he's also a very beautiful Dracula.
Yeah. It is funny when you grow up with an actor who's old by the time you start watching them and stuff. And then you see them when they're young. And it's kind of interesting who was really attractive.
I mean, he was in that and an early Mel Brooks movie. And I was like, God, he was really good looking as a young man. I get it now. I get the Langella love.
Yeah.
But nobody tops Udo Kier quite frankly.
Udo's
wonderful. And the ending was one, I mean, not to spoil it, but the ending is like wonderfully shocking.
And
really gory. And I was just like, whoa. You can remind me of Little Martin in that regard.
I know.
I was like, wow, okay, that was pretty freaking cool. Yeah. So yeah, this is in my top five of the Dracula movies.
Nice.
To my surprise.
I'm glad you got to see it.
Blood for Dracula.
Nice.
I have one more at Beyond Fest that I went to. I've multiple movies I had tickets to at Beyond Fest, and I keep having to give away tickets.
Did you finally see Parasite?
No, I had to give tickets away to a friend for that one because I just keep making it get busy. But Ant Timpson from New Zealand, who I've talked about many times over the years on the show. He's a producer, kind of similar boat to Travis Stevens, who was on last week. He made the shift to directing this year. But unlike Travis, who I think, obviously sounds like it's partially a career change. Like, it sounds like Travis is going to keep producing, but is really really focusing on making movies now. I got the feeling from Ant that it was about making this movie. And that made me very curious because I've known him for a very long time. I grew up with watching movies that he would curate in New Zealand. He ran a film festival called the Incredibly Strange Film Festival. I was wearing the t-shirt from his festival. He hadn't seen it in 20-something years. It was like 1996. I was like, yeah. And I'll be honest, it had Elijah Wood in it. I was expecting
this
it's called Come to Daddy. Yeah. And very little is out there about it on purpose. It opened Fright Fest and had really good reactions. But, you know, whenever somebody you know makes a movie that you don't really, you know, I saw a short he made like 20 years ago that I really liked. But I didn't know really what to expect. And I was kind of like going, you know, well, as long as it's fun, it'll be nice to say something. And I got to say, this will be in my top five movies of the year, not horror films, movies of the year. This movie is gangbusters.
Wow.
Best thing I've seen at Beyond Fest so far. It is so surprising. And I'll say very little about
it. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even know the plot.
The part that you can know and the part that's out there and actually helped me because it kind of goes
I know his personal story.
Right. So and also the Q&A really helped because it was so honest. It was him and Elijah Wood really talking about daddy issues, right? And I think if you have daddy issues, and I mean by daddy issues, I mean more like abandonment or early if somebody died when you're young. And I was sitting next to Mike Williamson. He's in the same boat as me. There's a few people I know of. With these kind of things, you watch it through a certain lens. But Elijah Wood is this really just the worst they've ever made him look. He has a terrible haircut. He's really fashion designery. There's something about him, and he washes up on this island where
he
shows up on this island. Okay, sorry. And it's very remote.
Different story.
It
is.
It's like Tom Hanks and Wilson. he goes to this remote house, and it turns out he's there to see his father, who has written him a letter saying. And he hasn't seen his father in 35 years. So his father left when he was five or something like that and has asked him to come. And he shows up and his dad is the Pontypool guy, which is awesome.
Oh, already. I love him.
Yeah, I love that actor whose name just totally escaped me from History of Violence as well.
I'll look it up.
And he comes and he's very surly and very, you know, a bit of a drunkard. And basically there's a good, like, you know, 15 minute where it's real a lot of back and forth.
Stephen McCaddy.
McCaddy, yeah. And it's just really kind of an intense thing, but they seem so different. And Elijah Wood's really trying to find out, why did you invite me out here? And he just won't give him anything, right? And they're in this remote area. And if you don't want to know anything else, you could just fast forward 2 minutes because this part is definitely out there. They get into an argument and McCaddy drops dead. Okay, now that is kind of the premise of the movie. This is all happening in the first 20 minutes. So he's now just had an argument and his dad's died. So what Ant's story behind this film, it's co-written by the Greasy Strangler. Well, the Greasy Strangler writer wrote it and then Ant looked at that and went, oh, okay, you took it in a Greasy Strangler direction. They kind of kept shifting it along the way. Ant's original thing is Ant's dad died in front of him. Like they were talking and his dad dropped dead. And he said it's a very traumatic thing to deal with. And then the guy, he had married a woman. His dad had married a woman who basically said to him, this is his story in the Q&A. He's like, you know, I think it'd be really good for you kids to stay alone with the body for the next week and just keep the body at the house. And, you know, I think you could just talk to it. And, you know, it's really good for healing. And then she just took off and left them for a week. And then all his siblings also go, well, we're really busy. And they all left. So basically, the aunt was then left alone with his dad's body for a few days in a house. And so this.
Wait, why do they not? I mean, like, that's illegal here. No, I mean,
in this, they give it a twist. They say, oh, the morgue's really full. You got to keep it here. So there's a couple big kind of ideas like that you have to kind of buy into. So that's just the jumping off point. And he said that's really the only point is commonality, like after that. But he said it was super creepy and super weird. And he did a lot of things Elijah Wood's character does in the first few minutes after this happens, like wearing the guy's sweater and trying to understand him. Because we're talking about not an Ant's case, but in this case, a terrible no relationship at all between these figures. And then this is all I'm going to go up to. So you can't accuse me when you see this movie of having spoiled anything. And then the entire thing shifts in such a – I haven't seen a shift like this since Kill List or – the other movie it reminded me of was Cheap Thrills in terms of the dark black comedy. It's not a horror film. It maybe touches on it. There's a couple beats where it feels kind of supernaturally like after the death. But it's way more in line with Cheap Thrills and as enjoyable in that kind of realm. And it's so much fun. And I won't even tell you who else is in it because basically this is a movie where suddenly like 5 minutes later it revealed another character who was like, holy shit, I love that guy. And then 5 minutes later, another actor, I was like, oh my God, I love him too. And I didn't know they were in the movie. So that feeling of discovery, and that's because there's not a lot out there. So just stay off the socials on this one. I don't know when it's going to come. And by the end of it, it's one of the easily top two or three things Elijah Wood's been in. Like he he starts off as kind of character I fucking hate in real life, the kind of person I would like an LA kind of person who I would not want to be around. And by the end, I'm totally rooting for him. So that is an arc when you can start in one place and really watch a character go through a lot of shit.
Who's doing Distro?
I don't know, but it has to be a pretty big release because it's you know, it feels
it's got a budget, obviously.
Yeah, it was like actors. You know, it's probably $1 million film. It's not got a huge budget, and it was really fun to listen because, you know, he could only Ant even said some of the best question of the Q&A. Christian said, "So why'd you cast Elijah Wood?" And he goes, "He's the only celebrity I know." And I thought, because they had made Greasy Strangler together and he wasn't lying, and Elijah Wood did it because he, you know, wanted to help him, and the script was great. So it's funny how it just comes out of this almost like friends just trying to help each other get a movie made, but it's really fun. And I got to say, it's rare that I get to go to movies where I don't know anything about the movie. And what I've told you, I promise, is nothing. This is the part that's out there. Anything that happens after, you are going to have fun.
Yeah, cool. I don't see any details of a release yet.
Yeah. Saban Films picked it up out of Cannes. So no release date yet, but it's coming.
And it's at Festival. So like keep looking out. And I did talk to Ant about coming on because I've been trying to get him on for years. And he said he was passing through, but I think it's right when we're in Knoxville, so we might have to wait again.
Oh, man.
But one day he'll do it. Because, you know, seriously, when we start talking movies with him, he's been giving prints to the New Biver over the years, all places. He's like one of the big print collectors.
No, that'll be cool. And
I've judged film festivals for him, and I've never met him.
24-hour film festival in New Zealand. Yeah, but great guy, and it was super fun. And I'd love seeing people achieve their dreams, like especially if it's not just about a career move. Like, it's so cool. I just need to make this movie, and then the movie's actually great. Yeah. And you're like, that's an interesting place, because I don't know what that leads to. But the one line he said that I thought was really great was he said, having directed this film, I'm going to be a much better producer now because I've really seen what I didn't see always behind. And the other thing that I found inspiring and I could identify with is he said the main reason he had to do it beyond the story was when you're in a place of comfort, you just get used to your life and you just kind of plod along and nothing happens.
Yeah.
And he said, when you feel that way, you should try to do something like to mix it up. And I was like, oh, you can certainly identify. So yeah, it was really great Q&A. I hope they filmed it because it was pretty damn funny.
Oh, wow.
Christian's actually really good at those Q&As at Beyond Fest. I got to say, like, he's one of the organizers of Beyond Fest. I always think he actually kind of nails some of them because I think he knows the people usually pretty well.
Yeah.
So you can kind of get in there.
Cool. Come to daddy.
Nice.
Yeah. Cool. All righty. Well, I think that's it for now. So let's take a quick break.
Yep.
Hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Cool.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Slasher Crasher, the debut horror comedy novel of David Nora. It was the night he tried to get home but got caught in their drama. It's Halloween, and Nick Roche is a towering figure of evil and stupidity. He's escaped from an upstate New York mental hospital he's been committed in for 5 years. Planning to return to his childhood home where he brutally murdered his babysitter's boyfriend, his plans are halted when he crosses paths with even more terrifying beasts. Two high school friends with some serious beef. Caught in a battle of loyalty that has been brewing for 10 years of their friendship, the two girls, Kathleen and Betsy, force the feud into a savage showdown, pitting the escaped monster against each other. Who will survive this epic deathmatch, and is it totally wrong to fall in love with the murderous lunatic who just tried to kill your best friend with a machete? It's available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and at BlackRoseWriting.com. For more info, you can find David Nora on Twitter and Instagram at David Nora Jr. Again, the novel is called Slasher Crasher. Hello, and welcome back to Shockwaves. And we have talked about having this person on for literally like 2 years now. We have a list that we keep, like an Excel sheet of everybody that we want to have on. And your name has been on there for a really long time. So I'd like to welcome Kaylee Marsh. She is a manager, literary manager, and she's also the creator of The Blood List.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Hello.
I've been trying to get on for 2 years. Yeah. I was like, I've been on for 2 years because slyly 2 years ago, I was like, hey, I'd love to be on Shockwaves.
And I think I put your name on the list that night.
The list is there. Yeah.
And thus,
we don't know why these things happen the way they do. It's just kind of a timing thing. But this is exciting because I don't think we've ever had a manager on, let alone someone that created a vehicle for writers to really get their voices known and recognized. So you're the first of this sort. And so where should we start? Should we start with?
Start by telling us a little bit about the Bloodless, because inside the industry, it's a big thing, but I don't know if some of our listeners at home might be as familiar with it.
Sure, absolutely. So it's actually crazy. The 11th version of the Bloodless, or the 11th edition, will be coming out this October, October 30th. But it started 10 years ago, 2009. I had just always been a huge horror fan. I had had a couple assistant positions before this, but I was an assistant at a management and production company called Circle of Confusion. And there, I was finding that being on tracking boards was a way to meet executives as a young assistant. And, you know, I just wanted to meet cool people who were common-minded. So I created something called Tracula, which was just a common interest horror tracking board.
And what's a tracking board?
Oh, so a tracking board. Oh, yeah. Try not to speak with so much inside baseball stuff. But no, a tracking board is just a way for executives and assistants predominantly to be tracking spec scripts that go out. Executive shifts, you know, if an executive goes from ABC to Marvel, like that would be listed. Rumors, in terms of things that will affect people, like 25% of the studio is going to be laid off next week because of X, Y, and Z. So it's just like a confidential way for executives and assistants to chat amongst themselves about things that are happening in the industry.
And when there's leaks, you get Dante's Peak and Volcano at the same time. This is why this happened.
By the way,
that's how 1989's aquatic horror boom happened, was a tracking board.
And by the way, like, keep in mind, this was a decade ago, so information was handled very differently. And now I feel like tracking boards are much more scarce, but they were really effective when I was an assistant as a way of especially tracking scripts. So anyways, long story short, I had this screening series through Dracula and everyone was asking me, they're like, you love horror? What horror writers are you reading? And I was like, yo, I cover 40 clients with my bosses and like five of them are horror. So if everyone on my board can tell me what they're reading, I'll put it together in a list. The annual Blacklist, which is a really big best of and most liked list that happens annually, had been around for a few years at this point, and there wasn't a lot of dark genre or especially horror on it ever. So yeah, I put the scripts that the executives voted for on this list. I put like a just Bloodlist in red with like some blood trickling down, some like Microsoft art shit, and just put the names of the scripts, and then it sort of went viral amongst tracking boards. And so the next year people were like, you're going to do that list again, right? I was like, I guess I will. And then, yeah, a decade later, I'm still doing it. So they
had to be represented scripts at the time that were already at agencies. They weren't like submissions, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's not black and white, but in order to be on the list, your script has to be in circulation enough that at least executives that are voting on the list would vote for it. Mm-hmm. So it'd be tough to say that someone could not be represented because it's hard to get your script out there in a real way without representation, which actually brings me to something that I'm really excited about with the Bloodless, a sort of an offshoot, Fresh Blood. So Fresh Blood Selects, this is the fourth year we're doing it. It was a real way to shine a light on unrepresented screenwriters, you know, screenwriters that don't have managers, agents, or attorneys, and whose scripts aren't being sent out in a regular way. For the past 3 years, it's free submission, so anyone can submit anything from usually May till September. And me and readers or my assistant or whomever, this year we have like 7 readers. I have a part-time executive, my full-time assistant, and me trying to go through all the submissions. We got over 500.
Oh, my gosh.
Wait a minute. But reading one script is always a pain in the ass.
It's a lot.
How do you make the quick decisions? Is it like do you have somebody do coverage? Do you do the 20-page rule? Or
sort of like the 20-page rule. I mean, if it's great, then we read the whole thing. Yeah. If not, like if I can – also, I've been a manager, I guess I should mention, for 9 years, a little over that. I started managing pretty soon after putting out the first Bloodless. It's had always been an interest of mine, at least since learning what a manager was. But yeah, I mean, I've been doing this for long enough where I can tell kind of like from page one if I'm if the script is good or not. It very rarely will redeem itself if by page one or two I don't like it. So, you know, we sort of just weigh it as best we can because it is free for people to submit. It's not free for us. You know, Brillstein bought the Bloodless for me when I joined, but all of this costs money. Our programmer costs money by the hour. These readers cost money. Our executive costs money. My assistant. So, you know, we're trying to do the best we can. But for the past 3 years, we've been able to narrow down, you know, 300 to 600 submissions, however much we're getting, into 10 of the most liked scripts that we've read. Mm-hmm. So we do the best we can. But like in the past 3 years, there has been a lot of success of writers getting discovered, represented. Actually, I need to remember to answer this email, but someone had emailed the account and it got forwarded to me of like, hey, like, you know, I need to take my script down from the site because it just got optioned and the producers are being worried about it. But I'm like, that's great. Yay. That's the point.
Yeah.
You know, now I can be like, oh, this was optioned. You can't read it anymore. Thumbs up.
That's a good note. Yeah, people can read them things online.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. So the Fresh Blood scripts, you can read online. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that these writers are the ones that are dealing with the people that are interested in the script. So their name is on the cover of the script. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can read the last probably at this point, like 27 scripts or projects on the website, bloodless.com.
So what are some of the Bloodless titles that have gone on to get made?
Yes. So according to Studio System, 23% of the scripts that have ever appeared on the Bloodless have gone on to be produced. I'd say the most notable ones that I love are The Shallows, which was In the Deep, Black Coat's Daughter, which
was February.
Their Words Not Mine, that being on the Bloodless for the script February actually helped get it financed, mm-hmm. like got the exposure it needed. You know, Black Swan, The Voices, like Mike Perry's script, The Voices, still one of my favorite scripts of all time. I like the movie as well. I like the script more.
I loved that movie.
I really liked it. It didn't get a lot of attention,
but I remember us covering it on the Blumhouse website, and then I watched it right afterwards, and it's a guy who kind of turns into a serial killer, but his cat and dog talk to him throughout. And yeah, it's just fun.
And like heads of people he's killed still talk to him.
Is that Ryan Reynolds?
It's Ryan Reynolds.
I never saw it, but I remember the ads running. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I mean, that was the number one script on the first Bloodless. Huh. But yeah, I mean, lots like... now, like, of course, like, as I'm thinking about it, I'm like, what was on there? Like, Scarecrow, which is now, he's out there. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like everything's gone through title changes, but yeah.
I'm looking it up online. Apparently, Arrival.
Yes.
Oscar nominated Arrival.
Wow.
It was called Story of Your Life, speaking of FKA titles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Eric Heisser is awesome. He actually was on there for Bird Box as well.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was Josh Malerman's book first. Yeah, I mean, like, Eric Heisserer has been great, like, always loaned quotes about Bloodless and stuff, is a huge supporter. I think that's what's been interesting about it and so fulfilling about the Bloodless is, like, Eric doesn't need my help. He's a big screenwriter. Mm. But, like, he's always gone out of his way to be, like, the Bloodless is something you should pay attention to, like, because he's a horror fan and because he's a fan of mine, I guess, now, after doing this for so long. And it's always nice to see, like, those more senior writers be supportive of getting younger voices out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the fact that the scripts are available for writers, like, the best advice is just read a lot of scripts.
Read some scripts.
Whether it's your favorite movies, you could probably Google it and find the script somewhere online these days, or just to see what is kind of gaining traction. But let's go back to the management part, because we've never had a manager on. I have a friend that technically says I'm his manager, so I don't even know what I'm supposed to be doing. So this is where you can come in. But you, basically around the same time that you were doing the Bloodless, you decided you wanted to get into management as well. So what's the difference? What does a manager do, and how is that different from other forms of representation, including an agent and all these other things for the layman?
Sure. Well, the job of a manager cannot be defined, truly, because you can be a manager and you can just be anyone's manager, like anyone could be a manager. I'm hesitant to say that, but it's just the truth. So I sort of promoted myself to being a manager after figuring out what a manager did in loose terms at Circle of Confusion. You know, growing up reading the trades, like I'm from Florida, but I would go to like Books a Million or wherever the fuck, like I could find Variety or any of these hard copy trades. You hear about managers and 10%ers because we get 10%. But, you know, you don't really know what they do. So it's really simple and really complex in the sense that you're sort of a writer or director or a creative's partner in every form of the word. Like I'm in and going to my clients' weddings, but I'm also like coming up with kernels of ideas with them and then taking it from that kernel to a finished film and pretty much helping in any way, shape, or form I can that entire process. So it's like I can be really creative or I can be more transactional depending on how I'm needed in that particular way by that specific client or project. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Like, you know, sometimes I'm able to find something through the blood list or through a referral. I get a lot of queries. I got a lot of referrals. And I'm like, wow, this script is amazing. I only need to do a little bit of work on it. But that's a luxury. It's like usually a script needs a lot of work.
Yeah. My manager reads every draft, tells me when there's typos, you know, tells me the name Alan's really dated. You should change it to Arnold or whatever the hip name is of the, like, it's literally just everything. Or even things like vampires are trending. Actually, I've never gotten that note. Oh, vampires are not trending. but yeah, like pushing it in specific directions. So yeah, it's kind of like a creative reining in, I'll call it. But at the same time, like explosion as well.
So, well, is part of it kind of developing over the years through your works at the agencies, kind of, for lack of a better term, like a Rolodex, meaning like creative types aren't exactly the best at representing themselves or opening doors or whatever it is, pitching. So are you kind of that midpoint trying to be like, well, because this is how I feel, not as a producer, but I know one person and then I know this other creative. They both have similar personalities. I feel like, oh, they would probably get along and work together. So is that the simplest version of what a manager can do?
Yes, I am introducing a million people. I'm always connecting dots. I would say I'm really good at my job because I'm very social and I like connecting people. And that's just like the biggest part of it. But also, you're sort of like mold people in a way too. Like I can take a writer and be like, okay, you have 16 scripts, but this is the best. So even though all of them are comedies except for this horror script, this is what we should lead with. And then, you know, once you find success here, you can do your comedies or whatever it is, like helping people realize where they would fit in the marketplace, not changing their vision of themselves, but sort of helping them find it. You know, I have a client who is sort of doing a little bit of a career shift and she wrote a piece of material that's completely different from everything else she's done. And I basically was like, fuck it. Like she had a little bit of success in this other way, but I was like, fuck it. Like, let's just act like none of that happened. And like, this is your thing. And we're excited about this. And I'm going to blast it out to everyone and it's going to create all the heat. And like, this is going to be your thing. Like I'm saying that that's what it's going to be because I know I'm going to put my energy behind it. Mm-hmm. And so it's really collaborative. Like you have to be really on the same page with your client because I'm pitching them all day and I'm pitching them in a certain way that I know people will want. Like if someone's like, oh, I really need this specific type of writer and I find out about that, I'll be like, this is this type of writer because they were adopted and, you know, they're African-American. They were adopted by white folks in the South and like, you know, they grew up in Guam and like, I know that there's this element in the script. It's like me really truly being like, this is why this person's perfect. So that's definitely salesmanship or salespersonship. So it's such a multifaceted job. Sometimes I just have to hear my clients complain about their day, and that's also kind of why I'm getting paid. You know, it's like I get my percentage to be a part of their life and help build their career. And a lot of my clients and I have worked together for a really long time, so we sort of like, you know, came from being most of the time, definitely me, like super poor, and then really growing our careers. And, you know, now I live a little bit of a more corporate lifestyle. I had my own shop, Kaylee Marsh Media, for like almost 6 years. Now I'm at Brillstein Entertainment Partners. It's, you know, a 50-year-old company and has a big name and corporation behind me. But like the way I've done business hasn't changed. But it's interesting to have the platform for myself and for my roster.
How many people... what's normal amount of people to manage, like just for any manager? Because I imagine if you're that involved in people's lives, obviously these careers ebb and flow, so you need enough people to keep living yourself, but to do a great job, what kind of number makes sense?
How Jerry Maguire are you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. show
him. My personality is like very Jerry Maguire. I'm like, fuck it. But no, I love Brillstein so much. People were like skeptical. They're like, really? Is that the right choice? And then now they're like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You're, you know, growing up or whatever. But no, I right now have like 24, 25 clients. I would know for sure, but like, I don't know. Like, it's like summer and writing teams or whatever. I don't really think about number. I just mostly think about bandwidth. Mm-hmm. For me personally, I'm on definitely the heavier side of what I feel comfortable with. When I joined the firm, I share a couple clients now. So that's why I'm also kind of like, on some people's teams. And then most of my clients, I run point on and do literally everything. Unfortunately, with the ATA and WGA stuff happening right now, all the clients of mine that are in the Writers Guild had to fire their agents, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so we're sort of figuring out what's happening, but I'm acting in most of the cases as their sole rep plus their attorney. So yeah, it's like completely different than it ever would be. So I'm feeling a little bit maxed out. Mm-hmm. So it's like when people are sending me incredible clients that I think would be really great, like I just don't have time and I don't want to get rid of clients that I've been building for a long time. You know, and I can't take on more people. Right. I think for the average amount, average manager, I would say in their first 5 years of managing, I wouldn't advise anyone to have more than 10 clients. Like truly, if you break one of your clients and make them a huge success, you can sustain your entire business as an independent manager off of just one client. And then if you're staffing clients, like, you know, I don't want to spout numbers on this podcast, especially since I know this isn't a screenwriting podcast, but like the average amount you're going to make on a show as a staff writer is like $4,000 a week before you pay out your reps. So that's a lot of money. So it's like, you know, if you have a couple of those people that are staffed and that's like the lowest level of a writer on a show, that's pretty good money. So, yeah, like I don't encourage taking on too many clients. If you're a manager, if you're an agent, some agents have 100 clients. It just depends on what you can manage.
So Ari Gold was an agent, not a manager.
He was very much
an
agent.
And Eric was the manager, right? His friend with the red hair.
Was that his name?
We're talking entourage, right?
Entourage, yeah. Well, I'm just trying to – because I think he's the manager. And that was the difference. So the manager is helping the person get – and they take 10%, but then the agent also takes –
10%.
So, and then the lawyer.
And the lawyer takes 10.
The lawyer takes 5.
The lawyer takes 5. Thank you.
Who else?
But do we really need agents?
Yes, you do.
Agents are important. I mean, listen, everyone can have their own opinion on an agent. I find them to be really helpful. If for no other reason besides anything they do for the client, I'm being privy to that information and can kind of attack that job from another angle. So it's like if you're being put up for a TV series and I know that executive, I'm like, oh cool, I didn't have to send that executive the script. I can poke and be like, give that client the job because they're perfect for it, blah 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 blah. But I'm not the only voice doing it, so having that team is really helpful. You know, some of them don't do anything, some of them do a lot. It's like everyone's different. Every individual agent and manager, no matter where they work, is completely different. So I can only say what I know. And I know a lot of agents and managers, but I wouldn't like speak on their behalf, you know, of how they like to work or what they like to do or how many clients they like to have.
How much crossover with the Bloodlist and your management is there in terms of horror? Like do you rep a lot of horror people or is that just – are they like two separate lives?
I like have tried to separate them so much over the years, but they're not – as separate as I'd like for them to be. I do have a very heavy horror and dark genre roster for sure, especially because so many people call me for that, that it made sense. I think for the first half of my management career, I was like trying to fight it. I'm like, oh, I don't just do horror, I do other stuff. And I'm like, fuck it. If you think I just do horror, then call me with all the horror things because it gives you a reason, it gives people a reason to call you. So that's good for all of my clients. The tough thing is having clients that are competitive with each other, which I feel like has been kind of a common thread of like, I can only have so many horror writers on my roster and there are only so many different types of horror. But you know, my clients are doing really well, especially my genre folks. So I found different ways, different things to do with all of them, but like, you don't want to put the same three clients up for every job. So it's like luckily they're all like different levels or have different skill sets or different, you know, have different pros and cons to them. So yeah.
Nice. So your top three clients.
No.
Okay.
That's like lawyer
three.
Confidential.
I don't play favorites.
How does that play your management? How does that play into getting producer credits? Because, for example, you know, you're listed as an exec producer on the Hulu series Light as a Feather, something like that. So is that because you brought more pieces of that puzzle to make that show happen that now you get a producer credit? Like, how does that tie into?
That show was awesome, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Oh, yay. Yeah. Yay.
I loved that one.
Cool. Thank you. Our second half of our second season comes out this Friday on Hulu.
Oh, today.
Light as a feather.
As of this airing.
As of this airing,
well, it comes out today. Yeah. We've made 26 episodes, and they will all be on Hulu starting Friday. Yeah, I mean, on Light as a Feather, that's different because I do rep the showrunner, Lee Fleming, and I do rep Seth Sherwood, who's a co-EP, but I was involved as a producer before I started representing, I think, either of them. Mm. I've been working on this project since 2013, and it was sent to me like as a query through Bloodlist by the author, and I sort of had just become involved in terms of loving the IP, and it was based on a self-published book of the same name. And so me and my producing partner on it, this guy, Brian Scherer, there's a lot of producers now because we've been working on it for years and years and sold it a couple times. So there's like people that have stayed on. But yeah, we put Lee Fleming on the project. And so he created it from there. So that one is like completely different. But for the most part, if I'm a producer on a project, it is client related and 100% depends on how much work I did on it. Sometimes I've done insane amounts of work on projects and I'm like, I don't think I add any value here, or don't want to get involved, because it's also tricky to produce client projects, because if they have to be rewritten or there's a big issue from higher up that they don't like what your client's doing, you have to sort of defend them and also yourself. And mm-hmm. It's tough. It's really sticky. Light as a Feather was seamless, and like Lee and Seth are amazing, and it was just so easy. And worse than Wood, I haven't had any bad experiences producing client material, but I've also not produced as much as I should or could have. My clients are super supportive of me as a producer, but I'll never like glob on. Mm-hmm. Takes too long to make shit. I don't want to be involved in something unless I'm like, I am in this for 5, 6 years, 10 years, however long it takes to get made, if it ever gets made. Mm.
Yeah. What did you let your taste guide those kind of decisions, or do you let the business side of your mind, or is it a little mingling?
I'd say it's definitely a healthy combo of both. Mm-hmm. Before joining Brillstein, it was very different because I was kind of like, yeah, I'll produce this, sure. And then I would actually do stuff from there. But at Brillstein, it's, am I producing it and Brillstein's producing it? You know, mm-hmm. they have a long track record of producing. I mean, they produce The Sopranos and even Sopranos, Tarjay.
It sounds all fancy.
I know. I was like, wow.
Sopranos.
That came out of nowhere. No. but no, Brillstein produces Sorry for Your Loss, starring Lizzie Olson, directed by our client mm-hmm. James Ponsoldt. They produce The Bill Maher Show and then Baskets, and like they produce a lot of stuff. So having them is definitely a value add, but it's also, you know, a different deal making process. Like we have a whole BA department at Brillstein. So it's not just me being like, yeah, I'll produce it and hopefully it gets made. And now it's like legit. If we're producing it, it's an official thing. Like it's in the logs. Our CEO and CFO are involved. So yeah, it's like I today a client, we got an offer for something and he's like, you should produce this. And I was like, let me think about it, you know, because maybe I just want to be involved as your manager on this and we can produce something that I feel a little bit more passion towards. Hmm. So it's kind of half and half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, how does it, I mean, because this doesn't sound like, you don't sound like someone who has time to right now read a lot of Bloodlust scripts.
Yep.
Like that job sounds like a very busy job. So how do you balance that with the responsibilities of what the Bloodlust, obviously you have other people work with you, but are those two worlds harder and harder to merge, I guess?
Well, now that I don't own the Bloodlust, it's a little mm-hmm. bit easier. And now that I have, you know, this executive, Ramsey, working with me, it's taking a lot of the reading off my plate, but I'm only reading the recommend or consider scripts. Okay. Like I'm not able to look at anything that's even a soft pass. There was like one short that got passed on that I'm a judge for Screamfest. I'm on the board of advisors. Like I'm a judge for Etheria and a sponsor. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I'm involved in all of these things. I'm juror on this, juror and that Fantastic Fest, whatever. But, you know, so I'm seeing a lot of stuff and there was something that I had flagged as like, oh man, I actually loved this one. So let's put that in. But I can't micromanage. Like, I'm definitely a micromanager, but I think that it stems from, you know, my company was called Kaylee Marsh Media, and I was like the only person involved in Bloodlust. So, you know, even if 15 magazines were like, Kaylee does not own the Bloodlust, people would be like, but Kaylee owns the Bloodlust, right? Like, you know, so everything's so associated with me that I do have to be pretty careful with how things are presented mm-hmm. and, you know, But yeah, in terms of reading, like I wish I could get in there and roll up my sleeves and read everything, but like I don't have the time. My clients come first, always, always above the blood list. It's always been the case. I love the blood list, but my clients are my priority and what makes me my like actual money. And blood list right now, what's exciting about it is that when Brillstein bought it, it's now a true production company. So we're starting to produce original content.
Oh, that's great.
Under that label or Brillstein?
Under the
or
label. Yeah. So Brillstein is the owner, and I guess Bloodless is a subsidiary. Mm-hmm. Like, we've never really had that conversation, but they full on own it. Like, that's like a contractual thing. And I'm happy about that because they're giving me the resources and the platform to really grow it out. You know, everyone from our CEO down is so like helpful and like fans of the brand. It's like actually pretty fucking cool. But yeah, so we're starting to produce original content. We have a couple projects we've set up. You know, I started Bloodless Asia when I was at BFAN in Korea, and we have a project that we're we have financing out of Korea through that. So yeah, we're trying to find stuff through those submissions for Fresh Blood. Hopefully there's stuff we can option. There's one project I just flipped for that I read based on it being a consider. It'll probably end up on Fresh Blood. Maybe we're going to make a producing play. The goal is that they're separate, you know, that those writers can have success stories that are not just Bloodless is producing, because that's not a success story necessarily. It's better if like Bad Robot finds it, options it, makes it with Paramount. But we found it from the Bloodless, and I'm like, yes. Mm-hmm. And then separately, we can be producing content. Yeah.
And less risky.
Now, I'm intrigued about what you have learned about screenplays, literally from years upon years of just reading endless amounts of screenplays. Like, how do you kind of decide what's the cream of the crop? Because even like personal taste, I assume, becomes a factor at a point. Like, you know, I tend not to like slashers as much as I like exorcism movies and things like that. Like, what can you tell us about screenwriting from having read so many horror scripts?
Well, just that it is, yeah, quite clear if a script is good or not, like very, very quickly. I feel like I definitely will fall on my sword for a creative decisions more than a lot of producers or executives or even managers. I'm all about the voice. Like, you know, I also love, I love like really high concepts, but it doesn't have to be, it can be a little silly. Like, I love haunted objects. So, you know, some people will joke with me. They're like, oh, you like, you know, all the
Amityville
all
sequels.
The crappy. By the way, I know haunted blankets and fucking microphones. I mean, but I love that shit. Like, I'm like, if they go all in on an idea, I'm super here for it. So much stuff, especially in the horror world, is so derivative that like, even with Light as a Feather, our show is not like truly reinventing the wheel, but it's really, really fun. And we really wanted to make it like a fun, spooky soap. Mm-hmm. And that's like what it is. And I feel like a lot, and we know what it is. And if we'll read a comment that's like, this show's the stupidest fucking show, but I can't stop watching it. I'm like, okay,
you're
cool.
Watching.
You're still watching, babe. I don't know. But it's like, I'm all about entertainment. And so it's like when someone truly is going like in and after an idea and keeps the stylized voice throughout, I love that. I don't know. It's like really hard to say. It's kind of like, what do you like in a man or whatever? It's like, it's a hard question because it's like every script is different. And sometimes I'll read a script and be like, yes, like I oh my God. And then, I think I'm like a visual, like I like stuff visually too. So like if a script has a lot of really similar names and it's hard for me to track, I just don't like it as much. Or, you know, on the page, I really like sparse writing. Mm-hmm. Like if I've read a page and it took me 10 seconds, I'm like, okay, I'll keep reading. If I, you know, open a script and it's 150 pages, I'm like, literally waving it like, who the fuck does this person think they are? It's crazy. Who are you? Like, that's nuts. And I just like probably won't read it. Like,
what is
that's
the perfect
crazy.
Length? Because I know a perfect length of a movie is 88 minutes. So
yeah,
I'm curious.
I
always say 90 page. Like, that's my script max.
I feel like 97 is like the lucky number for me. Yeah. I feel like I love sevens, but like I feel like anything past 107 pages, I am constantly wondering why.
Yeah.
You know, if I like the shorter the better. A pilot that I just developed with a client, it's like 28 pages or something, but truly took me like 10 minutes to read. And every time I send that to someone, I'm like, I know you have 15 things to read. This will take you 10 minutes. Time it. And every person reads it because people are busy and reading is very time consuming. And you want to give the writer, you know, their fair shake, but like like we're talking about, like you can kind of just tell if you like something or not. So you, I guess the other thing too, just a piece of advice to screenwriters is like some people, even if your script is amazing, will not read past page 20. So like,
that's what I'd always heard is the 20 page rule. So even if they love it, they will read 20 pages and then say, I love this. Give it to somebody else to finish reading for me. And then that's it. Yeah.
It depends on the level, but like, I just feel like sometimes I've stopped something after 20 pages and been like, oh my God, who is this writer? Like, I have to meet them. And then of course you read the rest of it and you're just like, I was hooked after 20 pages and here are my thoughts on the rest. But like, I feel like if you don't hook someone within 20 pages, like no one, if someone's like, oh, the end gets better, no one is going to give you that chance unless you're established or unless you have a really persistent, great rep that'll really go to bat for you. No one has that time. And like, scripts are too easy to send these days. Like, there's too many scripts out there. Yeah. It's too easy to get your script to someone. People will stop.
Has a script ever proven you wrong? Like, have you had one of these ones where usually you can tell that first couple pages and you get to, you know, something with a huge twist or something. Has anything ever come across your desk where you're like, oh, shit, okay, this took me in a different direction? Or
no.
Okay.
No. You know what? Actually, funny story. I was reading something last night and I got to page like 13 and before like falling asleep watching 90 Day Fiancé, let's be serious. But I was so tired. Wow. But I was reading it and I was like, wow, this script fucking sucks, but I have to read it for reasons I won't say. And I was reading it and I was like, God, this fucking sucks. Like, I literally was like noting it to death. I'm like, ah, like, this is so annoying. Like, why can't I watch 90 Day Fiancé? And then I got to like four more pages and then I was like, wait, is this good? And then like, I was kind of going back and forth and I fell asleep. So like, it clearly wasn't that great.
Tune in next week where we get the answer.
But no.
It was good.
No, but like, not really, right? Like, and it's also tough when people are like, oh, watch three episodes of the show. I'm like, man, but there's 500 shows I want to watch.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing.
You
got to
grab them. Yeah. I struggle with this ever since getting into distribution a few years ago, because it's like, all I do is watch movies all day or read scripts all day. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to describe when it becomes a blur. It's almost like you're reading something, you're watching it, and then there's like a little bit of life, and you're like, oh, wait, is that something good? This is different. Or it stands out like a sore thumb. And then the irony is you'll finish that and go to the couch and put on like a Vinegar Syndrome title. Like, what am I doing with my life? Like,
what am I doing?
Why do I want to watch this? I don't know. It's Russian roulette with Vinegar Syndrome.
It totally is. That should be their ad. It's Russian roulette. See what you get.
Great and a gem or woof. Yeah. Or it's going to be something Ryan likes.
Bloodhook.
Bloodhook.
I like Bloodhook, actually.
Okay.
No, well, by the way, you want to give everything a fair shot. Yeah. And even with TV, like, I try to watch everything. And I will say that in my friend group, yeah, people are always like, oh, you like everything, Kayla. You like everything. So I'm definitely like the person that will give you the shot. I think it's just like a... I guess going back to your question of what does a manager do, it's I have to be so passionate about it that I can convince someone to pay you hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases for your piece of material. Mm-hmm. And if I don't feel that way, I can't do that because I'm a really obvious read. So if I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's an okay script. You should take your time out of your day to read this okay script. Like, that's not a good sell and I'm a bad liar. So.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. What about your actual horror taste before you got, like, before, you know, back in the early days? I'm curious, what kind of films are you drawn to?
Besides Haunted Objects, which I totally love.
I mean, even just some of the classics, I'm always curious, like, what are the ones that made you fall in love with the genre?
Definitely. When I was super young, I lived with my aunt for a little bit, and her friends would always watch, like, the Nightmare on Elm Street films. My neighbor, Kamaria, and I probably rented Poltergeist 1 and 3 like 50 times. Like, definitely should have bought it.
Wow, that was such a great slam against
oh
2.
My God.
That was just like, boom.
That was it. No, but we agree with you here. You're
no, we like 3. We all like 3.
We love 3.
Oh, we're fans of 3.
3 is amazing. Yeah. It's great. Laura Flynn Boyle, great mirror use. Like, so good. I fucking love it. Like, CG'd Carol Ann, like, poor Heather. But the second one, I don't hate it. You know what, though? That fucking – I'm totally forgetting, like, the guy's name, like, the older guy with the white hair. Kane, yes.
Yeah.
My great-grandfather at the time, like, was passing away. It's, like, so fucking sad. But he looked, like, exactly him. So I actually found it really hard to watch that movie. I know he's like in another one too, but like the second one too, with it being so plagued and anything with like Native Americans, like mythology, it freaks me out so much. Okay, I don't know.
Well,
so
he was all, the guy that played Kanan 2 was actually dying as well. Oh. So yeah, it's a different guy in the third one.
He's actually a poet. Yeah. He's actually a
famous
poet.
I found the third
poet.
Guy really creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's really good.
And, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's... That's interesting, though. I'm glad we have all these love for three here. Yeah. That makes me feel good.
It's really good. Yeah. Third one's amazing. Yeah. I definitely feel like I watched Poltergeist the most. And then Tremors, I loved growing up. My dad was obsessed with Leprechaun, like loved it. He loved Leprechaun and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre films, though I'd be lying if I said I remembered which ones he watched the most. He passed away, so I've like referred to him in the past tense, but he watched the first one a lot. And so I feel like when we would do like the five movies for 5 days for $5 at 2020 or whatever it was, it would always be like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre films. Like we watched the same movies over and over and over. And then, you know, in college, I thought it was super cool watching all the foreign horror, like loved J-horror. And my roommate at the time was, I don't know how the fuck she did this, but she always was scoring cool, like, this came out of this festival, this came out of this festival. Like, I don't know where she got these movies. But by the time I became an assistant, I had a really good in with, like, getting all these foreign horror films. Yeah. And so a couple of the first Dracula screenings were, like, really interesting. Like I was just thinking about The Loved Ones the other day, which is, like, foreign-ish. You know, it's Australian. But yeah, like, those films, I was like, how'd you get that? Your Human Centipede. Like, these really weird movies.
So there was a sense that you were going to be involved in movies somehow, pretty much from the get-go.
Oh, yeah. I've always been obsessed with movies. Like, you know, the rating system on my door, like, had my room turned into a movie theater. Always buying new releases, always renting, you know, going to the library a lot too, because like it was expensive to rent movies, especially at Blockbuster or any of the bigger chains. But yeah, like lived at the movie theater, like would clean the movie theater so I could get free tickets because it was also expensive. Yeah, pretty much just obsessed as a kid. I guess now.
Are there trends you start to see? Like you and Becca was talking about that vampire films aren't really trending right now or something like that. But are you seeing interesting trends that you personally find are surprising or interesting? Because it does seem like all of this stuff is cyclical.
It's cyclical.
And it's sometimes related to our politics and our economy, but it'll take years to catch up each time. But are you noticing anything right now about the industry and the kind of scripts that are popular and that you're drawn to?
Not really. And I always try to stay away from thinking about trends because, you know, people can say that vampires and zombies are dead, but then you get a cool
perfect one. Yeah.
Like if you get like a Daybreak or a 28 Days Later or whatever, and then they kind of rejigger people's minds, or there's any remotely any kind of commercial success, and people are like, Zombieland 2 did amazing. Okay, zombies are back. Like that's just how this town functions.
Yeah, it follows the money no matter what. So as soon as something explodes, everybody heads that direction. And even still, I mean, I've said on this show many times that I think that zombies have been dead for a while, but what was the one I'm most excited to see from Beyond Fest is Little
Jim
Monster. Not the Jim Jarmusch.
Oh, Little Monsters, yeah.
Little Monsters, but it's zombies, and I am so excited to see that one. So, yeah, there's always
something.
What's
funny about that one? I watched the trailer, and the trailer did nothing for me. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to see it because everyone keeps saying it's interesting, and I think it's kind of the same with, like, One Cut of the Dead, which is my favorite movie this year. And if you're listening, you have to watch the whole movie.
Oh, my God. It was breaking my heart when people online were like, I watched 10 minutes and I don't get the appeal. And I'm like, just keep fucking going.
Yes. Turn the phone off and just keep watching. Yeah. But no, it's interesting. Online. Like zombies. Like I'm curious as hell about Zombieland 2.
Because I am too.
It comes out like in a week or two, and I've heard nothing about it at all, one way or another.
There's a giant billboard near my house.
I'm going to see it.
I think it'll do well. It's up against Maleficent 2, which I think is interesting. Full disclosure, we represent Joachim Rønning, who directed Maleficent 2, and he was in the office today.
I think you're right. Like when you're looking for that original new one, but when I'm seeing the trailer to, even though it could be amazing, to Zombieland 2, I feel like I've already seen it because I've seen all the, after the brilliant first one, I've seen all the movies that then ripped that film off, and now I'm tired when I get to that sequel. Sometimes, and usually that's why sequels are sometimes better closer together. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this like? Probably 10 years.
It's 10 years later.
So now if they play on that, maybe it's going to be super cool. Like it's going to be fun. And they got all the people back. So it could be a great movie. But I just know for me, that's harder. And also we're different types of viewers, right? I like something new. every time. I'd rather go to see something new and unknown than another thing that was familiar to me, but I'm probably not. The mass American appeal might not be the same.
So. My grad students who would have seen Zombieland when they were like 12 or 13 are so fucking excited about
this. There you go.
It's going to do really well. I mean, also, it's funny because it's like, those actors are such great actors that I think it's going to add that extra level. Because we don't usually get zombie films starring Academy Award winners, you know? Right.
Yeah.
Which shows
not
how much they love the first one.
Those actors are – I mean, because they did a pilot for Amazon. Remember the Zombieland?
I do.
I don't remember that.
Oh, I think Rob and I watched it in the office, didn't we? Yeah. Oof.
And it's not Woody Harrelson or any of those people, so.
It needed some love.
Is it Ed Begley Jr.?
No, that would have been cool, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of funny.
I don't know why. Well, The Dead Don't Die had Bill Murray, which is kind of like Zombieland. I was thinking, I was hopeful, but no.
No.
I still got to watch that one.
I haven't seen that one either yet.
It's like, I mean, it's Jim Jarmusch has moments of being Jim Jarmusch, but again, these are films, sometimes they feel tired of the genre.
It's Zombieland, you know? Sam's the whimsy. Like, it's just weird.
Well, let me ask you something about, and I don't know if you have a client like this, but one movie I'm very fascinated about that's about to come out is The Lighthouse, which we talked a little bit about.
Oh, yeah.
Which we all saw.
And I to like me, that is a studio who is 100% backing the vision of a very specific director.
Mm-hmm. Not commercial at all.
Not commercial. Uncommercial. It's not horror. In any,
it isn't. So it touches enough on horror that you can sell it.
It like winks at it twice.
Yeah, but that's enough to sell.
No, it isn't.
But from your perspective,
they are. It doesn't matter if it is or not. They are.
Is it more valuable to have somebody like that that is just 100% pure vision? Like, you know, every time I get like, oh, that's so and so who made that movie, versus somebody that does have a commercial ability that you can make money off of because they're going to hit a lot of people. You know, like, where's the balance between, I guess, what you would say art and commercialism in terms of your clients?
It depends on what their goals are. And I think that you always want to make sure that they're feeling creatively fulfilled. Being a director especially is super challenging. You're most cases not getting paid anything until cameras are rolling, and you're doing sometimes years and years of work for before that. So I feel like you want to make sure that your vision and your clients align. I mean, Eggers can do whatever he wants because people really love The Witch. And so I feel like if I represented him, I would want him to do something a little bit more commercial, but I would have been like, get these out of your system because you have people's attention. When I was at Fantastic Fest, I saw this movie called Jala Khatu. It's this Indian film, and I was fucking blown away by this filmmaker, Eliho Pellissieri, I want to say is how you pronounce it. I was just so blown away. I reached out to him, but it couldn't have cost too much. And it's just like a bunch of villagers or people in this village chasing after this bull that got let loose. And like, that's the movie. I just was so blown away by the filmmaking. If let's say I represent him, he doesn't strike me as someone who's like, yeah, I'll direct Godzilla. Like, he's probably like, I don't give a fuck about Hollywood. If I cared about Hollywood, I would have come there. Like, clearly I'm talented. Apparently he's made other films that are amazing as well. I need to check them out. But like someone like that, I'm like desperate to represent someone who just is truly like just making a movie that they absolutely want to make. Cause I feel like no matter what the budget, that'll always come through in the filmmaking. You know, you get someone like a Christopher Nolan, which clearly started with smaller films and then, you know, went on to the Batman franchise and did really great work because it felt really authentic to him as a filmmaker. And so I feel like I think you should just be 100% on board with what your client wants and then make sure that you help them get the best version of it and that they're protected if they are making a more indie film that they're not getting screwed over. But yeah, of course you want to make money off your filmmaker, but you will, you know?
It's part of it like being almost like a lost leader. Like I'm thinking A24 as their model and they see a lighthouse and they know he's popular with the cult section, but this won't be a commercial film, even though it's got a commercial star in it. They could also, though, this does help our brand and it kind of solidifies what we do. And then the next film we put out of the 10 maybe needs to hit that other mark. I don't know what else they have on tap this year, but this is the most A24 of any of their movies so far. Like it's a triple down in a lot of ways. life, but in a, like in a really fascinating way, I think, you know? But is that something, I mean, I don't know how much of that side of the business you're privy to, but is that how some of the companies will think? It's more about, oh, well, this represents the brand well, even if it's not going to necessarily make a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, A24 has done the best example of it. I think also Blumhouse as well. It's like, you know, Blumhouse isn't just doing horror projects anymore. Yeah. Jason started not in horror. He started in acquisitions and doing much more, you know, dramatic based films and television. And that's kind of what he's gone back to in a sense now, but only after he built such an incredible horror brand and then had everyone's attention and was like, I have other interests and I'm going to do that. And so I think it's the same thing with filmmaking. But A24 has just done such a great example as a quote newer company. You just know, you can see a trailer and be like, that's an A24 movie. Mm-hmm. And like to have that brand recognition in such a short amount of time is really unparalleled.
You know what's weird about that is because you say Jason Blum and you say Blumhouse. I say Annapurna. If you say Annapurna, I know Megan Ellison. I have no idea. I've watched every A24 film. I'm a huge fan of the brand. I have no idea who's behind that film. Couldn't even tell. I wouldn't even know.
Oh, yeah. There is no like.
I don't know who the two guys. I'm blanking on their names.
I don't know the
I think they're brothers, actually.
It's so weird when I think about it. Yeah, I got to know.
That's actually kind of cool, though.
No, it shows that the actual brand itself is the only thing speaking for what they're doing, which is interesting.
From what I've heard, A24 wants to take projects from like start to finish in-house. Like they want before the script is ever written. Like you don't take them scripts, you take them ideas is what, or you take them early scripts. Like they want it to be something that they can kind of like start from the beginning and push forward from there.
Definitely more now than ever. They also, you know, they hired Ari Aster's manager and they're kind of growing out their management component internally, sort of like what XYZ is doing. It's like these companies that are finding these incredible filmmakers, nurturing them, giving them their start. So I think it's interesting that they're transitioning a bit into management as well, or having that as a branch. But yeah, I mean, they're like, I, you know, without getting too explicit with it, I have something that I'm sort of working on with them right now. And it was definitely deeper development and earlier than I thought it would be. It was mostly just me wanting to introduce them to this really cool female filmmaker I started working with. And I, you know, put her in there. And then from there, the exec's like, I really love her. Like, what else does she have? And so it was definitely an earlier conversation than I traditionally would have thought of for them, which I think is interesting, but also goes back to, it's harder to find stuff that fits your brand. It's easier to create it from scratch of being like, this is our brand, do it in our brand, you know?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, this is like, this is the side that we never get to go into, really. Like, we, you know, we have a lot of writers who maybe will sometimes tell us a little bit about their deals, but this is like a totally different side of the industry, which I think is really interesting, especially with horror, because a lot of people listen are probably writers, you know, which is pretty fascinating. Oh, what about, do you have any tips? Because you've already laid down some pretty interesting tips about screenplays, but in terms of how to approach to get a manager, you know, for, because so many people won't have a clue how to make that step in their careers, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, actually I kind of think it goes back to your question about, you know, like what's popular or what's out there. It's, you know, like there was a spec that just sold called 1031 and I'm blanking on the log line, but it's something like, you know, all these things happen on Halloween, you know, but it's like just shit going down on Halloween when that, and you think that, oh, that's so simple. Why didn't I think of that?
Just the title alone,
and
right?
Exactly. Yeah, and there's just so much built in IP there. I feel like the more simple the idea, the more people you're going to get behind it. I feel like horror, especially since these are probably horror screenwriters that are listening, it's so easy to make things feel derivative, but the simplicity is what makes things feel original in a strange way. You know, like if you look at like It Follows, such a simple concept. I'm not thinking of like, oh, well, what if the, you know, what if it, you know, goes in the water when this person can fly to France and like, will it get there in the same amount of time? Like I did find myself thinking that, but that was only like the fifth time I had seen it. I was like, oh, like asking all these logistical questions. When you're writing your screenplay, like just have fun with it. Just have like it, more simple the idea, the scarier you can make it, because you'll actually have time to focus on the characters, which is always the most important thing. Especially in TV, like characters are all that matters in TV. And features, it's a lot more concept based, because you do have to kind of hook someone in with this like clear hook. But yeah, I don't know. I just feel like when I read something, even if it's the most simple thing, if the characters are great and you're able to create like a cool atmospheric vibe and have some kind of scare to it. Like, you don't, it's so rare to read a script that's actually scary on the page. And there's a big difference between something that's really gory and gross, because it's easy to do that. It's easy to be like, oh, and then this arm gets ripped off and the blood splatters in this little girl's face. Like, that's easy to write. What's scared is to make us give a shit about this little girl and this person's arm that just got cut off.
Yeah.
And so I think it's focusing on the characters first and then putting them in a very relatable backdrop. And I think something also to think about is, like, if it could happen to you and that scares you, it'll scare other people. It's not rocket science. But I feel like in the horror genre, especially opposed to every other genre, people are always like, and then this happens, and then this, and then the alien invasion. I'm like, it has to be really simple, because the number one things executives are looking for is mythology notes. And, like, once you start getting noted on mythology, you're going to keep getting noted on mythology. Mm-hmm. People get really weighed down. I'm sure you can relate.
Oh my God, yeah. I call it pipe. And I'm like, don't make me put more pipe in my film, because the more pipes you put up, the less you can actually see the project that you were originally building. And so, yeah, but you'll get that note repeatedly of, like, but why does this ghost exist? Actually, there's a Supernatural episode of the TV show Supernatural where they're on a set that is supposed to be, like, doing a show about them. And one of the exec yells down, because the demons can hear what the people are saying, and they're like, well, how do demons hear in hell? And then they had to put an explainer in about how demons have unusually large ears. And that is such a fucking exec note. That just I felt that I'd had that note before. But yeah, it's just things like that you get. And you don't want, that's the same thing my agent tells me all the time, is you do not want readers to, like, think while they're reading, why couldn't demons hear this? Like, you want them to be enamored with the concept so that they forget all of the logistical questions while it's going through.
And I don't think audiences want that kind of story. Like, I don't think they actually want the pipe. I don't think they want backstory. They don't want prequels. You know, they might get them because people think they want them explained. But even Quiet Place or Quiet Ones? Quiet Place. Even that, like, I feel like at a certain point, I'm like, I don't need to know as that. Anymore about
and that was
like,
another
I just want
one.
It super minimal with the monster.
That, like, on the fifth viewing, I was like, so how does she give birth? Is this like Scientology birth where you can't make a sound? Like, how do they have sex? How do they keep the baby from crying? Like, suddenly I had all these questions. But, you know, the first viewing, I didn't even think about any of that shit. I was just in for the ride.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't think about the pipe till much later.
Yeah, if you're feeling, you're not thinking, hopefully. So
you care about the characters too. Yeah. That's the thing, is you're like, if you're invested in the character, you're not like thinking about everything. Oh my God, like, why is this going to happen to Maggie? Like, why is this unicorn going to kill her? You're just like, oh, well, unicorn's going to kill her. I'm sad about that, you know?
We were talking about Us earlier, and that was a big one for me where while I was watching it, I was like, this is just great scares. And then I think it was as we were walking to the parking lot, I was like, how did they get shoes down there? Because they all have the matching shoes and scissors. Like, how did they get that shit delivered? But it didn't dawn on me so much.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, and that's it. I was like, it was a fun movie. I had a lot of fun in it. It really doesn't matter how they got the jumpsuit.
Well, I think with that movie, because I'm with you, I love that movie, but I think we would care even less about that if they didn't have the one scene that starts to give you exposition. Because if you give a little hint of exposition, your brain
the one with when she's like in the is it a classroom or something?
Yeah, and she's like, and we were tethered
together. It actually
together,
felt a bit like a studio
note. It was like a government experiment, and I was like, don't tell me any of this.
I wish they pulled that out. They need to have a cut without that.
No,
scene.
because what it's not the, and I was trying to explain to people, it's not that the scene itself is terrible or anything. It's passable. The performance is good. What happens to your brain is your brain suddenly turns on and starts looking, thinking. And when you start thinking,
how does that all
you start looking at everything because they're explaining that part. But had they not explained, to me, that film would be as good as It Follows had that scene not been in it. Just for me personally, because I love Us. I think it's one of the best directed movies.
Yeah, it's great.
It's such a cool movie. But it's like that one part, everything starts, your synapses start firing. And I don't want to think suddenly in a horror film, especially at the end of a horror film.
It's so funny because
like, I want to enjoy it.
It's like, It Follows is a movie that worked for me much more on the second viewing, like completely by myself in my setup at home. And you know, there was that whole fun back and forth where Tarantino's like, oh, it's almost perfect. I have some notes. And the director's like, I'd love to talk about your notes.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. The fact that it's ambiguous is why
I
keep thinking about it and keep like going back to it.
It's more like
way.
A Lynch thing where you get to project, you as the audience are projecting a little bit of you into the spaces that haven't been answered.
Yeah.
The problem with movies where it's all answered for you is there's not, no space for you, and you're suddenly like, okay, yeah, I see it. And you, usually you can get that. That's like the trailers that answer all the questions for you.
Yeah.
It feels like a desperate plea to show you what, oh, you need this. And you're like, I've seen this. You know?
And I know I've talked with you guys about this before, but It Follows was one of the movies where right after we watched it, we were at an audience Q&A with the filmmaker. I loved that movie. And then as soon as the filmmaker started explaining, I started liking it less and less and less. And then I was like, just stop.
I love the part where he's talking about trying to find a giant in Detroit. it's really hard to find a giant in Detroit.
Interesting stories, but when he started talking about it relating to STDs and teen pregnancy and all this stuff that I started going, And then it wasn't until like the third viewing that one of my students proposed the question to me of what if at the same time two people, like, because you have to assume this is now a web of people who have assumed this, and what if at the same time two people die, so now there's two other people who have had sex, how does the creature decide which of the two people to follow? Because it's not always going to be a straight line. And then I was like, I don't know. So yeah, but that wasn't until like the third viewing. But I loved it right after seeing
That's
it.
That's a movie they could easily do a sequel to.
Oh, no,
oh my
I'm
God,
surprised.
We talked about that.
I'm so surprised. Yeah, so we'll do it in 10 years.
I'd like a sequel to. Yeah.
Well,
no,
by the way, actually, that's something interesting too on the screenwriting end. Is people are always thinking about stuff of like, oh, this could have 7 sequels. I'm like, no. You don't understand. It gets a sequel if people love the first one. Focus on the one that's in front of you, the one that you're writing, and if it's good enough, it'll get a sequel.
So if it's good enough, it gets a space movie. Yeah. Alien space.
If you're lucky enough, you go to space.
Yeah. You have yet to do one of those, right? You haven't had space. Okay, so we'll work
Not
on that.
Not me yet.
No, I was just going to reiterate, like, yeah, make one great movie. Like, literally the last 3 Terminator movies were made as, this is the start of a new trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and none of them have been a trilogy yet. There's a trilogy of movies that were supposed to start trilogies, but not.
The last trailer gave away so much. Every trailer gives away a lot. But just have a shot of him opening the door, I'll be back, and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, that's it.
And
like, people see it.
Yeah. Yeah, it does feel like
we'll see about that one.
Yeah. Well, I've learned something. This is good.
Oh, cool.
I feel enlightened in a way, so that's good.
Yeah.
Yay.
Anything you want to add, just in case we didn't cover everything, what will you do? It seems like it's pretty.
Yeah, where can we find the Bloodlust online?
So bloodlust.com, and on social media, it's like at the Bloodlust on Facebook. I think just at Bloodlust on Instagram. I guess I should know. But yeah, if you like horror, go to the website. If you like screenwriting, go to the website. Thanks for being supportive of the Bloodlust.
But there is a part where anybody can enter. So anybody who's listening who has a screenplay or a screenplay idea, you can submit to Fresh Blood.
Yes, during certain times of the year. Like, I usually start it in May because inevitably people do different drafts of their scripts. So I don't want them, by the time they submit, to be like, we rewrote it 7 times and we wish that we submitted a better draft. And so that was sort of to avoid that happening. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been pretty great. And we're narrowing down the 10 that'll end up on this year's Fresh Blood. So I'm excited.
Awesome.
Submit it if it's good. Don't send them like your worst script. No,
don't send your first draft either. Send your 7th draft.
Make those first 20 pages
make
awesome.
It count.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't want to get the reputation of like, oh, she only reads 20 pages. Yeah. I would read all the pages all the time if I had literally one more second of my day, but I don't.
I think they heard the part where you said you can tell them one page.
I know, but people get so offended. I'm like, this is not personal. Yeah. It's like, I want to love every script. I'm like the person at the, like, I wanted to get one dog, and I was like, maybe I should get 7 dogs. Uh-huh. Like, I'm like always trying to like, well, I want to keep reading, but then I also like don't get to see my friends or family because I never have any time. Yeah. So it's that like weighing sense. Costs.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool. You know, when you sat down, it was funny. My brain, I couldn't for the life of me remember. I mean, I feel like I met you when I first got here, like 8 years ago. So I could not tell you. I have no idea how we met.
None. I don't know either.
I have zero. Like, I'm like, did we do something at Jump Cut with the Bloodlust? But then I'm like, hey, it's so weird. And usually I can remember, like, I remembered the first time we met you. But as soon as you sat down, I was like, I have no idea. Maybe through Stacey Lane Wilson.
Maybe. You wanted to do a live reading of a live script reading of something. Bloodlust scripts at Jump Cut, but it was like around the time that it was sort of like, I don't know, absolving.
Like you're blowing up. Okay, yeah. Anyway, I always find that fascinating though when you meet people in the sound, when you've known of people for a long time, sometimes it is hard to go, like, where did we all meet? That's a weird horror community.
The horror community is so tight.
Yeah, it was so tight knit. Like, I have no idea where I met you. Yeah. I can't remember for the life of me, but I've known you for years.
Probably a film festival?
I feel like it was probably a film festival, like Etheria or something.
It might have been Etheria.
Yeah,
probably. I love Etheria.
I love Etheria, too. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah. So this today's episode is brought to you by Etheria and A24. Thank you.
Whoops. Well, thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I've been wanting to come on for years.
Yeah. And we have Rob's doing a solo episode next week.
Yes, it's already in the can. Next week, I'm talking with Patrick Lussier,
right,
director of the new movie Trick, as well as My Bloody Valentine 3D.
A lot of 3D fantastic stuff, right?
And great stories.
Drive Angry.
Nick Cage.
Yep.
This is the guy that edited all the Scream movies, so we get into that too.
That's
nice. Pretty cool.
Yeah. And then after that, we are appearing at Salem Film Festival.
Well, we are.
And yeah, Rob
You're in
and
Canada.
I'm in Canada. But Rob and Elric will be at Salem Film Festival.
Tales from the Crypting
that weekend.
With
yep
the Crypt Keeper himself, John Kassir.
And then the weekend after that, I am joining them straight from Canada in Knoxville Film Festival.
With a topic TBD. We haven't announced it
and
yet.
And Girdlerfest is
Girdler
Girdler
right on the first night. Girdlerthon.
Yes. If you've always wanted to see Grizzly with the three of us, this is your chance.
That's
been your weird dream.
The only time it's going to happen. Not in the Manitou.
And Rob wearing a thong. If those three things appeal.
I never
it's
going to
say grizzly on it, too. A we, grizzly thong.
We got you wearing shorts this year. I think this is the natural.
One step at a time.
We're going straight to thong, guys.
Happy Halloween season, guys.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you soon.
Yeah. Thank you.